Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring the mind of Christ to bear on the issues of our day so that you and I can enter into today's conversations, not just giving people a piece of our mind, but actually giving people the very peace of the mind of Christ, which is, you know, ultimately what folks need. All right, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. You can read my blog and other ministry information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And in response to listener Frank, who called yesterday, I have posted some notes today at the Connecting Faith page at myfaithradio.com. So there you go. Tons of stuff out there for you if you are looking for material resources to help you do what we do here on air, which is bring the mind of Christ to bear on the news of the day. So let's jump in. Today is, in fact, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. I've been talking about this now for a few days, highlighting a two-day conference that is wrapping up today in Memphis. It's called MLK 50 Conference, and you can actually still go to MLK50Conference.com and live stream the program. You can see what's actually happening there. You can go to the Facebook page for the ERLC, that's the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church, or the Gospel Coalition also has it posted as a live stream on their website. So you can actually find resources related to this particular conference in lots of places. Here's why I'm highlighting it. This is not just white people talking to white people about solving issues of much needed racial reconciliation and actually advancing on Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream, not only his dream, but real reconciliation that alleviates the systemic problems that we have in our country related to race, which are things like poverty and injustice and on and on and on. So the MLK 50 conference is led by a bunch of really astute theological folks who are very, very diverse in terms of their backgrounds and ministry contexts in which they serve, and certainly their skin color. And today I wanted to highlight something that was announced earlier today at the MLK 50 conference that's really meaningful to all of us, and I guess I hope inspires us to do something like this in our own communities, in our own churches, through our own schools and spheres of influence, because that's really ultimately what this is about. This is about people who have material means, have access to the levers of power, own the means of production, et cetera, people who would be considered privileged, actually getting to the place where we leverage the platforms that we have to benefit those who have been kept from such things for generations. And so at some point, we actually have to share the wealth, so to speak. So there's lots of ways in which we can do that, and this is just one. So this was the announcement, and it's also located on the ChristianityToday.com website today. And it's this: MLK 50 launches a scholarship program for students from the city of Memphis to attend. I mean, there's 20 schools on the list already. I would expect the list to grow. But they announced it today. 20 Christian colleges, universities, and seminaries have raised more than $1.5 million in scholarships to offer minority students in Memphis in honor of this Martin Luther King Jr. 50th anniversary conference, because the organizers of the conference really didn't want this to just be a two-day event where people came together and heard really inspiring speakers and had the opportunity to worship with folks from North and South and East and West, and virtually every nation of origin who now populates the United States of America. But they really wanted this to be a movement or part of a movement, the flame of which it feels like the Spirit is fanning across the nation in terms of actually bringing genuine systemic change. The education system and issues of education come up all the time when you're having a conversation about racial inequality in this country. because inequitable education and particularly the lack of opportunity or access to the kind of education that you might be providing for your own children or grandchildren because you are able to either physically move or send them to private schools and provide for them the kind of education that makes it possible for them to then become genuine leaders in every field of work and labor and certainly within the church. So they've raised $1.5 million in order to do this for students in Memphis. And you're saying to yourself, well, I'm not from Memphis and I am just, what would it be? I'm just selfish enough that I'd be interested in doing this if it was actually for kids from my own community. Great. Great. These folks actually want to provide you the opportunity to do that. So the MLK Conference website has an opportunity for folks who say, hey, my church would like to do something like that. My school would like to do something like that. Or I would like to do something like that personally for the kids in my city, in my community. I'd like to get on the right side of these conversations and actually participate in this kind of scholarship program. Well, you have the opportunity to do that. And that would be my encouragement to each and every one of us. Maybe it's as simple as scholarshipping a kid in your community who otherwise would not have the opportunity to go to a Christian school. You actually scholarship them personally to go to a Christian school. I mean, find a minority student. This is not rocket science, people. Find a minority student who is in every way qualified and desirous of the kind of private Christian education that you are supplying to your own children or grandchildren, or would be if you had them, and do it for your brothers and sisters in Christ. Do it for people with whom you share the blood of Jesus, in order that we might actually begin as the church leading the racial reconciliation conversation in this country instead of always lagging behind it. So could your city or your school or your church do this kind of a thing? I'm suspecting that you can. And so if you go to the MLK50conference.com website, you can actually find out about this particular scholarship program that's in Memphis, but you can also find out more about how you could do this yourself. And it's also posted at ChristianityToday.com if that's an easier website for you to remember. All right, I have another. These are my Easter people stories for the day because it's Easter week and I think we ought to be celebrating the Easter people and what the Easter people are out there doing across the country that really is genuinely good and godly and demonstrating grace and the redemptive power of Jesus. So I got another one for you. This is about a Dallas area megachurch called Covenant Church. I'll tell you, I got goosebumps when I read it. So they decided that instead of doing the kinds of things that maybe other churches do, which is sort of treat Easter Sunday like the Super Bowl of Christianity and, you know, do tons of advertising, and pour money into things that ultimately would maybe bring people to their church but may not genuinely transform the culture around them. And so this Easter, they went a different route. Here's the paragraph from the article on stream.org says, Covenant partnered with a nonprofit group, and it's RIP Medical Debt, which is rest in peace. That's what that is. RIP Medical Debt, which acquires unpaid medical debt with greatly reduced rates and then forgives it. So the church donated $100,000, and that eliminated a total of $10,551,618 in medical debt that was owed by more than 4,200 households or families in the Dallas area. So here's what happened. On Easter Sunday, 4,229 families in the Dallas area found out that their medical debt, totaling more than $10.5 million, had been paid. It'd been wiped clean. They owed nothing. It had literally been forgiven. Now, I got to tell you, I mean, if that doesn't give you chili bumps, if that doesn't give you goosebumps, if you don't say to yourself, that is the gospel. That is the gospel transforming culture. That's the gospel of Jesus Christ with flesh on. That's resurrection faith. That's Easter people ministry. That's what the Easter people are out there doing in this week of Easter. And so let me just encourage you. Maybe you're saying to yourself, wow, my family has medical debt. That is an inspiring story. Well, maybe you need to connect with this RIP medical debt, rest in peace medical debt. And maybe you're a person who says, wow, I have known medical debt in my family. I know how incredibly debilitating and discouraging it can be, how it can ruin every plan you ever had to send your kids to school or on and on and on and on. Great. Then you also know the power of a gift to an organization like Rest in Peace Medical Debt in order that they can take your gift and they can obviously multiply and transform it in ways that I just consider absolutely breathtaking. So again, this article is by Josh Shepard. It's posted at stream.org and it's entitled "With Easter Donation, Dallas Area Megachurch Rips Up $10 Million in Medical Debt." Highly recommend this story about Covenant Church in the Dallas, Texas area. All right, friends, I can't believe it, but we're already up to our first break. So I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to be joined by Jonathan Morrow. Jonathan is the director of cultural engagement for an organization called Impact 360. And they, along with Barna Research, have done a lot of discovery about Generation Z. I'm going to have to learn it. Generation Z. It's the crowd that is now 18 and under. Don't you want to know more about them and how to impact them for Jesus Christ? Well, Jonathan Morrow is going to bring us up to speed on all of that when we come right back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Don't go away. Hey, friends, this is Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm joined by Jonathan Morrow. Jonathan is the Director of Cultural Engagement for Impact 360. You can actually find him at jonathanmorrow.org. Now, the reason I send you to that website is because, I got to tell you, I roamed around there this morning. Jonathan has incredible resources posted there for those of you who are in high school or in college or care about those who are in high school or in college, because he has this Christian worldview and apologetics ministry where he is actually helping us help the next generation live faithfully in the context of the real culture versus the culture that we would like to imagine exists. So, Jonathan, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Carmen. It's awesome to be with you.
So you're the author of several books. Let's folks know the newest one is Welcome to College, A Christ Follower's Guide for the Journey. And they can get that. They can hook up with that information at jonathanmorrow.org. You're also an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola. And so, we sort of recognize you have all of the credentials to be helping us as we seek to turn to help the next generation. But we have to understand who that is in order to even start talking. So let's talk about the Generation Z research that your organization at Impact 360 did with the Barna Group. Who is Gen Z?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So Gen Z is the generation coming along after the millennials, and they would have been born between 1999 and 2015, so under 18. They're also going to be the largest American generation at right around 69 to 70 million once they all mature and grow up. So a pretty significant generation that's going to be honestly reshaping a lot of what we experience here in our culture, especially in America.
All right, now let me be quick to tell people, we actually have three Gen Z research books, which, you know, when I say it's a research book, it's way cooler than your average research book.
Yes.
But we've got three of these Gen Z books on the research related to this generation provided by Impact 360 and the Barna Group. And so if you're listening, a person engaged in student ministry, you are a person engaged in family ministry or children's ministry, or you've got a kid in this age group, or you're interested in reaching this particular generation, let me just encourage you to either call us at 877-93-FAITH or email us at connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com, and we'll get you a copy of Gen Z, The Culture, Beliefs, and Motivation Shaping the Next Generation. All right, Jonathan, so You interviewed these 13 to 18-year-olds nationwide about their faith, home life, friendship, social activities, media and technology, their goals for life, political beliefs. I mean, it's a pretty thorough study here. What do you feel like you learned about their assumptions and values?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So we did this national survey, and we also did focus groups, which was very enlightening. And then I get to spend a lot of time with students on a day-in, day-out basis here at Impact 360, training them in our gap year, nine-month gap year, and our summer experiences as well. And so we knew the questions and ideas and thoughts and insecurities that were typically there. But, you know, one of the things that really emerged was just how confused this generation is. And for that, that we could go into, but one of the things that we're seeing is they're just confused and unsure and uncertain, especially when it comes to moral and spiritual questions, but also around just all the information that they're being bombarded with. And so they're viewing life very much from an individualistic basis and very much from a pragmatic basis, which is a little bit different than the millennials before them. So those are just a couple of the high points. I know we can dive into some of the particulars as we go.
Yeah, so let's dive into one of the particulars that really caught my attention. I mean, there are some findings in here that are going to surprise people. I was a little horrified by one in particular, and that was only one-third of teenagers. Now, I'm going to remind people, this is a current like point in time now. We're talking about teenagers now, 13 to 18 years old. Only one-third of them believe that lying is wrong. So, Jonathan, talk with us about the moral shift that's obviously taken place and what that means for our life together if only a third of teenagers, 13 to 18 years old, actually believe that lying is wrong.
Yeah, you know, that was interesting because as we were kind of putting this study together with the great people at Barna and their team, you know, this was actually – I was like, okay, great. Well, let's come up with a baseline question on lying before we get to the really difficult stuff about the other topics. And then it came back that only 34% could agree that lying is morally wrong. And what that really, I think, underscores is that we fully are in a post-truth culture. And I think what that also shows is just the lack of moral knowledge, and people think that we can actually access it. And what I mean by that is we live in a culture where science rules, and science is awesome, especially from a Christian perspective. We're big fans of science. The problem is people think that science is the only thing that can give you knowledge. You can't have knowledge about moral and spiritual matters. Therefore, you only have opinions, and then you make those decisions based on emotions and feelings. And that's really where Gen Z lives, is they don't really have anything else to make those decisions on other than feelings and freedom and autonomy and some of those kinds of things. And so what that's going to cause us to have to do is really back up the conversation down to the question first, is does truth even exist about moral and spiritual things or not, and how would we know those things? Because as you were saying, how we have a conversation about these things, if we can't even establish certain baselines, means we really need to not make many assumptions. In fact, that's one of the things, especially with your audience, I would really encourage thinking about Gen Z is I wouldn't make any assumptions, Christian audience or not, that they're all on the same page with you. I would start with defining your terms and making a case for things all the way at the back at the beginning. And I think this statistic on the moral kind of erosion is a really good kind of indicator on kind of where we're at. You know, it's I don't say that in any way to be negative. I'm actually a big fan of Gen Z. They're great kids and teenagers. They just have grown up in a culture that's told them there is no such thing as right and wrong, and you can't know it. And they're really confused on that.
All right, and then we get to the percentage question, and actually now I'm thinking there's people who are listening who are saying, I didn't know I needed this research until now, and now I know I need it. So let me just tell them again how they can go about getting it. So, hey, if you just call us on the studio line, it's 877-93-FAITH, or you send us an email, connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com. We'll get you a copy of this really important research done by Impact 360 and the Barna Group called Gen Z, the Culture, Beliefs, and Motivations Shaping the Next Generation. My guest is Jonathan Morrow, and you can find him at jonathanmorrow.org. So, Jonathan, from there, let's just jump into, because like we thought that lying was going to be an easy question, and then you sort of say, you know, because we wanted to set up ourselves, you know, get a baseline before we started getting into really complicated, complex, hard questions like gender and identity. So let's go to that subject. So your research shows that 7 out of 10 teens believe it's acceptable to be born one gender and feel like another gender. And a full third of our teenagers personally know someone who has changed their gender identity or is in the process of doing so. So let me just ask the church-related question, which is this. You know, how are children, youth, student, and family ministries in churches actually equipping Christian kids to function in a culture where these most basic realities, truth and identity, are not considered fixed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one other statistic to bring in here, too, is that 33% of Gen Z say that gender is how a person feels and not their birth sex, meaning gender does not have anything to do with biology at that point. And so what do we do with that? Again, I think, and you kind of mentioned this early on, I think there's a world that we wish there was, and there's a world that is. And I think in many ways we've been preparing students for a world that we hoped would be there for them when they graduate high school and things like that, as opposed to the reality of the way it actually is. And because of that, we've put off certain conversations. We haven't had the harder conversations. We haven't done the training, honestly, necessary to do these things well. So what I would say is we need to reevaluate what we're doing and how we're spending our time. You know, one of the statistics was about our average teenager spends 4-plus hours a day on screens. I mean, that's probably, and that's some of them even more, you know. And so that's a ton of information. It's shaping them. They're being marketed to nonstop. They're also being given narratives around transgenderism, sexuality, freedom determines how what's real, all these things. And yet we've got, what, 15 minutes of a youth group sermon or 30, 40 minutes of a sermon on a Sunday morning to kind of counteract that for most people who even attend church. A lot of Gen Z doesn't attend church, and they're kind of more of a blank slate when it comes to this. So my big overarching thing is, you know, the entertainment culture around youth group and church kind of things like that is not preparing a generation of students who can flourish in this post-Christian culture. We need training. We need to equip them to think well about their faith and why they believe what they believe and how to talk about it, where it connects to everyday life, and then also give them opportunities to practice it, because that is a major opportunity for us. But if we don't change things, I think you'll continue to see the continued kind of degeneration of this generation's worldview when it comes to kind of what they believe about truth and God and the questions that matter most.
All right, Jonathan, we're going to have to take a break here in a second, but I want you to tell people what Impact 360 is and how you guys are actually doing what you just talked about the church needing to do. And I'm guessing you're more than happy to come alongside our listeners and help equip them to equip the next generation. So tell us quickly what Impact 360 is, and then when we come back from the break, we'll delve more fully into these subjects.
Absolutely. So I work with Impact 360, and you can find us at impact360.org. And we really want to help cultivate leaders who follow Jesus, and we work with the next generation. We do that through 1- and 2-week summer experiences for high schoolers. And we also have a 9-month gap year called our Impact 360 Fellows Experience for high school graduates age 18 to 20, where we want to be an ally for you as a parent or as the church to come alongside your high schooler to really help equip them and provide experiences where they can really own their faith and not just be swamped and kind of reframed by the culture to believe things that aren't biblical or God's thoughts. So that's what we're doing at impact360.org.
All right, friends, we're going to continue the conversation right after the break.
Remind me of this with every decision. Generations will reap what I sow. I can pass on a curse or a blessing to those I will never know.
Hey, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We're continuing our conversation with Jonathan Morrow of Impact 360. He and I are having a conversation about research that Impact 360 did in partnership with Barna. The product, the report, is called Gen Z, the Culture, Beliefs, and Motivations Shaping the Next Generation. We're talking here about everybody 18 and under. And when you think about everybody 18 and under, you know, you're thinking about a group of people for whom the smartphone has always been a part of their lives. They are what we call digital natives. 9/11 is an event in history for them like World War II. Like, it is not something that they have any conscious memory of. Their parents are Generation X and millennials. It's the most ethnically diverse generation alive today. And they have grown up with technology literally at their fingertips. Jonathan does ministry with this age group of people at Impact 360. You can find information about the ministry at impact360.org. You can find Jonathan's ministry resources at jonathanmorrow.org. Jonathan, again, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Well, it's great to be with you, Carmen.
Okay, this summary book, which, you know, I'll remind listeners, we've got some copies of, so you can call us at 877-93-FAITH or email us at connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com if you want a copy. This summary book of research that you guys did says this: the percentage of people with a biblical worldview declines in each generation. So boomers, 10% of the boomer generation have a biblical worldview, 7% of Gen X, 6% of millennials, 4% of Gen Z. Tell us what that means in terms of how you guys defined biblical worldview. And then, you know, what are the implications of that in terms of living in a post-Christian era?
Yeah, great question. So working with David Kahneman and the excellent team at Barna, one of the things we wanted to do is get a snapshot on how this generation, Gen Z, that's the generation following millennials, how they compared with previous generations on this scale of kind of a, what is a biblical worldview, so that everyone was working with the same definitions, tracking them. And like you said, boomer generation, 10%. Gen X had 7% of biblical worldview, 6% of millennials, and 4% of Gen Z. So obviously that trajectory is not good. And here's the thing. That definition, basically some of the common things are there are like, okay, you've made a personal commitment to Jesus that's still important in your life. You strongly agree that the Bible is totally accurate in all of its teachings. You know, you believe that there is a devil. You believe that God is all-powerful, all-knowing, things like that. But it's a pretty minimal section. But what this does is rather than asking someone, hey, are you an evangelical Christian with a biblical worldview, check yes or no, which is not going to be super helpful, what it does is it has lots of questions that they answer, and then they get categorized into it. And what we see basically is less and less Christians, less and less people in general, by generation, being able to answer anything that remotely puts them in that field of a biblical worldview, because our culture in some ways is Christianized, like it's got some of these, it's God-haunted in some ways around Christian themes and things like that. But what this data reveals is that that is eroding very, very quickly. And so what does that mean for us? It means that we are fully entering into a post-Christian generation where for many, I mean, millennials, a lot of them had bad taste in their mouth from church and Christianity because they kind of were disillusioned. In some ways, Gen Z is more of a blank slate. They're kind of like, what is this thing called Christianity you want to talk to me about? Why I think the church is important? I'm not even sure what that believes. Yeah, that's interesting. So you're a Christian. Tell me what that is. You know what I mean? It's more like that. So in some ways, that presents both the opportunity and the challenge for us. The opportunity is we get to start framing Christianity for people again. So that's good. The challenge is less and less people are equipped on how to do that in a way that's engaging and doesn't make assumptions like, well, the Bible says so, now let me argue from the Bible, when most of our culture is going to reject that out of hand. So when we see this decline, what that means is that less teenagers today than really in any generation in recent history over the last 20, 25 years have a biblical worldview than ever, and that's something we really need to pay attention to.
All right, now you just freaked people out a little bit. Because what they heard you say was, we're not going to use the Bible, which I clearly know is not what you meant when you said, we're not going to, you know, say, well, the Bible says it and therefore you should believe it, and live by it. So tell us, make that transition for us. How do I operate out of my biblical worldview, and how do I allow the Word of God that He has already spoken to speak through me, without sort of bringing out the physical Bible and beating people over the head with it?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for the opportunity to clarify. Because I do say that, and people look at me and it's like, well, do you not believe the Bible? I'm like, no, no, no. I absolutely believe the Bible. I hold the inerrancy and inspiration of it. I teach that at the master's level, graduate level, and undergrad level, and high schoolers. So fully affirm that. But here's what I mean by that. We live in a culture that doesn't speak Bible anymore. They don't have a shared common vocabulary. And they certainly don't have a shared authority, because here's what's going to happen in those conversations. Well, why would you believe a thing like that? Well, the Bible says, and they're like, well, wait a second, I don't believe the Bible. So they swipe that aside. And for many people today, the Bible is no longer the answer. It's the question. So it's not a matter of our posture towards the Bible, because it's authoritative. The question is, how am I helping this person connect the dots around questions that they care about and questions that they intersect with that the Bible clearly addresses. Because what we know is that God has also given us general revelation, where the law is written on human heart, moral conscience, you know, Romans 2:15, Romans 1:20, that the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen through what's been made, 1 Peter 3:15, that we're always to be ready to give an answer for the hope that we have, yet do it with gentleness and respect, because everybody out there is made in the image of God, even if they really disagree with us and really don't like us. We still must treat them with respect because they bear God's image. So what it does is it allows us to go, okay, well, let's talk about Jesus. We just celebrated Easter. Hey, have you ever considered what the earliest biographies of Jesus say about who he was and what he claimed? Well, I'm talking about the Gospels, but a lot of people have never read those, or they might dismiss the Bible out of hand. But what we do is we get Jesus back in the conversation about history, that there really is historical evidence you can investigate around the resurrection, and something happened, and how do you best explain it? We can draw people into a conversation like that without saying, well, you should believe this because 1 Corinthians 15 says this or Matthew 28 says this. And that's what I mean by that. We have to be wise and ask questions and build bridges and make connection points between a biblical worldview, which we need to understand, and where our culture is at. The problem, though, is less and less people feel equipped or are equipped to understand a biblical worldview first and foremost, talk about why it's true, and then go, well, how do I make those connection points? And that's kind of where this research on Gen Z really shows us we need to kind of raise our game and take it to the next level to equip this next generation, because this cultural moment is one that's really going to make us really be able to explain why we believe what we believe and talk about that in ways that don't necessarily just include the phrase, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it.
All right, friends, this is Jonathan Morrow. You can connect with him at jonathanmorrow.org. If you're thinking to yourself right now, I need some help with what he is talking about. I got kids that I love. I certainly have a culture that I am interested in impacting. I certainly want to be able to represent Christ well to the next generation. So clearly I need to understand that next generation better than I currently do. The research book is called Gen Z, The Culture, Beliefs, and Motivations Shaping the Next Generation. It's published in partnership between Impact 360 and the Barna Group. We've got a few copies to give away, and you can call us at 877-93-FAITH, or you can email us, connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com. Jonathan, you can find Impact 360 information at impact360.org. Let me just go to the rubber hits the road question for me personally, you know, because it's my show, so I ought to get a selfish question in every once in a while, right? So, all right, I got a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old living in my house. What do I need to stop doing? What do I need to start doing if I genuinely want to help them live confidently as Christ followers in the culture that's really out there versus the one that I wish were out there?
Okay, great question. So I'll do my best to give a couple of actionable items, because there's plenty of things we can do. And so the first one is this: find ways to help your children not be able to play Christian, meaning just go to youth group and hide, or go to church and check a box, or if they go to Christian school, or if they're homeschool or whatever, where they just go, okay, I got this. And then what that happens is that becomes a very small circle, a part of their reality that happens like on a Sunday during that Christian or faith part of their life. And then everything else happens during the rest of the week, and those are two separate worlds. So what does that look like? So when they come home from youth group or Bible or church or something, hey, ask them over lunch or meals or dinner or something, hey, what'd you learn today in youth group? And kind of draw it out, usually after the games that they talked about they played and all the candy and everything else, which is fine. I have nothing against candy and entertainment. But once they say things, go, well, that's interesting. Why would you believe a thing like that? And just kind of be quiet. And just kind of let them struggle a little bit. Because what I think we need to help our students do and our teenagers and our kids do is feel the weight that this is either real or it's not. It rises to the level of being true or false. It's not just true because we happen to be Christians in our household and other people aren't. They're Buddhists or Muslims or whatever. And help them feel the challenge of that. That's a critical thing. Ask good questions and let them struggle with those. Don't feel the need to back the truck up with 28 hours worth of answers yet. Just kind of go, that's interesting. Well, why would you believe in God anyway? Or how do you know the Bible's true? That's interesting. You just let them struggle a little bit. That's good. Narrate what's going on around them. cultural through social media, information, internet, movies, films, watch a show with them, narrate what's going on. Hey, pause it. I mean, it'll be annoying, but that's what we need to be able to do for them, is to help narrate what they're seeing, because no one else is narrating around them. And the last thing, just to be as clear as I possibly can be on this one, stop. If you're out there and you're just giving your 12-year-old or 13-year-old a smartphone, just stop. Don't do that. Now, you may get them one, but don't just hand them one and then turn them loose, because one of the things that's going on there is they're getting addicted to technology. It's raising anxiety and depression. They're getting information overload. And there's a whole worldview that they're being kind of trapped into without anyone to help them, in the social media wars and competing for likes and all that stuff. So don't just give them a phone and pretend they're going to figure it out, because it is a very different world in which we live. So we need discipleship around technology and social media, not just, hey, you know, just watch this and you'll be good and make wise choices. That's something we need an active level of discipleship into. So those are a few things off the bat, but I would say help them know why they believe what they believe, bring some more challenge into their life, take off the bubble wrap some, and then kind of be there while they're still under your roof to coach them and give them some insight, as opposed to waiting for them to have some of those conversations when they're 18, 19, and away from home, when they may not have you around to talk to them about.
And then when they reach the point where they're eligible to do so, send them for a couple of weeks to an Impact 360 summer program, or let them do a gap year between high school and college.
Yeah, absolutely, because one of the things I've found is that training, especially training outside of their normal environment, is really effective, because what we can be is an ally to reinforce those things that you are doing as parents or as the church or youth pastors, to say, hey, here's the gift of space. We get them in an environment. We not just study about other worldviews. We go interact with different people. We take them to a mosque. We let them interact with an imam. We debrief that whole thing with them. Hey, what do you think about what they said about the Quran or Muhammad versus Jesus in the Bible, and why? And so what happens is these things become real, and it gives them an opportunity to own it. But if there's no struggle, there's no ownership, and we want to put them in environments where they're going to flourish. But to do that, you have to kind of get them out of this kind of playing Christian, check a box, pray the prayer, went to camp that 1 year, sang those songs, and I'm good. You know, it's this culture eats that up in about 30 seconds. So we need to really train them to have a resilient faith, to know why they believe what they believe, and we'd love to be an ally for you here at Impact 360, impact360.org.
Jonathan Morrow, I feel like you and I are going to talk frequently, so thank you so much for being with us here today on Connecting Faith. Friends, you can find him on Twitter at Jonathan_Morrow, at jonathanmorrow.org, and at impact360.org. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Hey, Carmen, it was wonderful to be with you.
All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking with Tim Muehlhoff. He is going to, we're going to be talking about Channing Tatum and Jenna Dewan, whose names I'm sure I'm mispronouncing, but they're Hollywood people who you probably know about. We're going to talk about Christian marriage and why it's different than what the world thinks. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, you know him. You love him. It's Tim Muehlhoff. He's back with us again today. He's a professor at Biola. What I appreciate, one of the things I appreciate about Tim is that he's paying attention to things that are going on the left coast, particularly in Hollywood, that I may not always be paying very close attention to. And so, Tim, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Hey, thanks, Carmen. Glad to be here.
So we are going to talk today about what makes Christian marriage different. And to get into that conversation, we are going to use this announced split of Channing Tatum and Jenna Dewan, who have announced that they are choosing to separate as a couple. But it sure doesn't sound like anything that you and I would have perceived even in the past of like, hey, these guys have actually legitimate reasons to end their marriage. So talk with us about this story and what makes Christian marriage different than what at least this current generation in the world thinks.
Yeah, Carmen, we need to be aware of the narratives that we're getting through pop culture. Pop culture is incredibly influential in the lives of our kids, my students at Biola University, even ourselves, right, as adults, we're consumers of pop culture. So when a couple as famous as these two, Channing Tatum and Jenna Dewan Tatum, decide to split, what caught my eye was how they announced it. Now, on one hand, I'm all for couples not going through nasty divorces, especially when you have a child. They have a five-year-old daughter. So I appreciate the fact that they want to make this amicable and not make it nasty. I think all of us are aware of nasty splits, you know, especially in social media. So on one hand, I greatly appreciate how they're trying to word this, but in their wording, we get a narrative of what's governing their marriage, and I want to ask the question, is there anything different about a Christian marriage? So here's what they say. They say, we have lovingly chosen to separate as a couple. We fell deeply in love so many years ago. They've been married going on 9 years, and they've had a magical journey together. Absolutely nothing has changed about how much we love one another, but love is a beautiful adventure that is taking us on different paths for now. There are no secrets, no salacious events at the root of our decision, just two best friends realizing it's time to take some space and help each other live the most joyous, fulfilled lives as possible. We are still a family. We'll always be loving, dedicated parents to Everly. We won't be commenting on this beyond this, right? So thank you in advance for respecting our privacy. So what strikes me about that is just this attitude of, you know, we're friends, we're lovers, but we've just kind of moved on, and we feel like there could be more outside the marriage, right? And we're going to support each other in this decision that we're going to continue in this magical journey, but it's going to take us in different directions. Now, I guess from a world's perspective, I sort of kind of get that a little bit. I mean, it's like, hey, listen, if we're no longer as in love as we were before, then why stay in this? Why not find something bigger and better for us to take a look at? And we're going to be committed to our daughter no matter what. So I give them kudos for that. But it just strikes me, Carmen, that the Christian narrative is just flat out different when it comes to marriage, right? We believe Absolutely. That two people come together, become one flesh, and that together they reflect God's love, and that they're not going to separate. Because if they do separate, imagine what that signals about God's love. It means that God's love could end. It means God's love could stop. And yet, a Christian marriage, you go through the hard times because it's not just about your personal happiness. It's more about your holiness, and it's more about sharing with other people what God's love really looks like embodied in a relationship.
Well, I think that's one of the parts of this, Tim, that really stood out to me was the word love and the way that they use it even in their statement. We have lovingly chosen to separate as a couple. We fell deeply right. in love so many years ago. Absolutely nothing has changed about how much we love one another. But, and here's where they kind of try to define it, love is a beautiful adventure that is taking right. us on different paths for now. So I think that also from a Christian perspective, love is, you know, the nature of God. It is God's mandate upon us. It is God's gift to us. And it's the fruit of God's spirit within us. And so even yeah. even the definition of love that the world is operating on and the definition of love that the Christian is operating on, they just couldn't be further apart.
Yeah, and let me mention two comments. I love what you just said, Carmen, from a biblical perspective, but let's take a look at this from a relational perspective. So I'm with the Center for Marriage and Relationships at Biola University. Let me comment on two things. One, it's a magical adventure except for Everly, right? It's a magical adventure for the two adults, but we know from research that at age five, for her to go through this divorce is going to have lasting impact upon Everly, their daughter. And I don't care how they do it, right? The separation of losing a father, losing a mother, you know, now it's disrupted her whole routine, how she views things. So part of me wants, and again, I don't want to be overly critical of a couple I've never met, but I want to say, but it's not a magical adventure for your daughter. Right? This is going to be a traumatic event in her life. It used to be that people stayed together because of the kids. Right? What was best for the kids? And now we've gotten past that. to where you get two Hollywood starlets saying, hey, this isn't good for us as adults anymore, then I would have quite frankly said to them, then I'm not sure you were ready for marriage or to have kids, right? When you have kids, those of us who have kids, it really changes the equation. Second, I would say that research shows from a psychological standpoint, it takes 10 years, Carmen, for you to hit the rhythm of your marriage. They're ending it going into year 9. So they've not even given it 10 years to see, hey, what is the rhythm like at 10 years? What's our journey like? They're calling a stop before the 10th year that could maybe get them in a rhythm. But again, it's too self-centered is what I'm reading. That doesn't take into account what we know about marital research, and it doesn't take into account their daughter. Well, Christian marriage says, you know what, there's going to be some hard times. There's going to be times you want to go find your own adventure, but God is calling you to something higher than that, right? And you self-sacrifice for each other. Paul says, you can look out for your own interests, but I want you to get into the habit of looking out for the interests of others, and that might be your children, and it might be your spouse, and it might be looking out for the interests of God, what he can do through your marriage, not a perfect one, if you don't call it quits.
Oh, Tim Muehlhoff, you always bring us great insights. I think the one other thing that I thought about when I read this was that we seem to imagine in America right now that marriage is something that we choose, we define, we can end, we can manipulate. And that is, I mean, ultimately not what the Bible says marriage is. Marriage is actually this eternal covenant relationship between Christ and the church. And marriage here on earth is simply, you know, intended, I think, to be a foretaste and or reflection of that, not the other way around.
Yeah, Carmen, I so mm-hmm. agree with that. You know, what we've done is we've gotten rid of the reference points, right, for what constitutes marriage. So there's a fascinating study that's been replicated 3 or 4 times. Your listeners could find it if they just Google walking straight while blindfolded. So they do this study where they put a blindfold on you and they tell you, I want you to walk in a straight line. And Carmen, it is hilarious if you look this up. People actually do a big circle. They cannot walk in a straight line. They can't even go 100 yards in a straight line because their eyes are blindfolded and they have no reference points. So I'm afraid what's happening in culture today is we have gotten rid of our reference points, traditionally as well as biblically, and now we're literally walking with our eyes blindfolded and everybody's kind of doing what they feel is right. And I think I'm fearful that we're just going way off direction if we get rid of all of these transcendent markers that we used to depend on as a culture.
Okay, I love that. So walking straight while blindfolded?
Yeah, it's hilarious to watch. But sad that we've gotten rid of historical, traditional religious markers, reference points. And I think we're seeing the results of it in our culture today.
Well, and that just really reinforces the conversation that we just had prior to you and I talking today. I was talking with Jonathan Morrow about the study that Impact 360 did with the Barna Group about Generation Z. And everything that you just said, especially this part about removing all of those transcendent reference points, if the millennial generation and maybe even Generation X was living on the shadow of faith, Generation Z, they don't have a shadow of a shadow. And so there's just nothing left for them in terms of, let's say, truth or identity or purpose. Yeah. And those are certainly the things they're searching for. All right. We got to leave it right there.
Okay.
Tim, we look forward to having you back in a couple of weeks. Thank you always for joining us. All right, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We are completely out of time today, but visit us online at myfaithradio.com. I have a new resource posted there for you today on the Connecting Faith page. You can get more information about Tim and what he's up to at biola.org, and you can get information about that Barna study at impact360.org. All right, friends, this is Connecting Faith. Go out there and make your faith real in the world by helping people reconnect the eternal with the everyday and do so in ways that honor Jesus. You are actually the evidence of Easter in the world today, so go be Easter people. All right, have a great day. God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.